about the concept of Jewish meditation. And the very idea of Jewish meditation is an interesting concept, where, first of all, it seemed like, and in the terms that it's just been described, you know, it seems like an interesting bringing together of different concepts. Meditation isn't that something people do far away, to the east, east of Eden, indeed, far away. Isn't that where people meditate, and then a whole wave of meditation groups and meditation circles, which invaded the West through the 20th century, a very interesting cultural transformation as European scientific men, in the spirit of Romanticism, began exploring further and further afield in order to discover some kind of non-Western spirituality. That's what we normally associate meditation with. And Judaism, we think of as the very essence of Western spirituality. Surely, you know, we speak about the Judeo-Christian tradition, and Judaism, the religion of practice, action, the letter of the law, how does it all fit together? Well, Judaism exhibits many different faces. And as the sages tell us, there's 70 faces to Torah, 70 panim la Torah. And Jewish teachings have always spoken about different levels of Torah study. As is well known, the story of Rabbi Akiva and his three colleagues, his three students, who entered Pardes, who entered the mystical teachings of the Torah, and as described in Chagiga, the tractate Chagiga of the Talmud, and it was a tremendously dangerous experience. It was an intense mystical experience, and he warned them before the journey. He said, when you reach the hall of white marble, do not say, Al tomhu mayim mayim, do not say, it's water, it's going to engulf us, it's going to destroy us. You will be misunderstanding it. And he tried to tell them that, but nonetheless, each of the three, in one way or the other, came to harm. One died of ecstasy. It was such an intense experience, he died. And the Talmud comments, he was a tzaddik, he was wonderful, he was a very spiritual person. But that's not the path. The path is not to die. Another one became a recluse. He was no longer able to be married, to be in the daily world. That also is not the path. The third one even left Jewish practice. And that's certainly not the path. Rabbi Akiva entered in peace and came out in peace. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichron Tzadik Livracha, he explained, if you go into this mystical, spiritual domain with the goal that you are going to come out in peace, in other words, you enter with the goal that you're going to leave it and come down back to the world, then you can go in such a way that you go and you reach something radiant, something holy, and then you come back out into the world and you are able to bring that into the daily world. Now, there we have an example of this spiritual dimension in Judaism and the kind of spirituality that that passage, which is in both the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud, that passage describes is a very, very intense form of spirituality which has been identified by a number of people as what is called in Hasidic texts Aliyat HaNeshama, an ascent of the soul, where the soul rises to higher and higher levels. I am not going to talk about the techniques for ascent of the soul. It is something certainly totally beyond me. It is something for a Rebbe, for a tzaddik, someone on a higher level. What I'm going to try to talk about is something very different, but which does apply to us here in this room. And that is another passage in the Talmud. It says in the Talmud, see, in the Talmud you have everything. You can find it all there. The Talmud speaks about the Hasidim HaRishonim, the early pious ones, who would pause for an hour before prayer, then they would spend an hour praying, and then they would spend an interested in the logistics of things. How does this relate to the practicalities of a Torah study? If they spend 3 hours praying Shachrit, Mincha, Ma'ariv, that's three times a day, that's 9 hours a day. When were they going to study Torah? When did they have time? Then a person has to eat and has to sleep. When were they going to study Torah? Would they have enough time? And it says, yes, because they were so spiritual, their Torah study was blessed. They might have spent less time in practical terms, but what they learned, they remembered, and they saw to the depths of it, and they understood it. And what about making a living? And it says, well, they were blessed in that as well. Because they were involved in such spirituality, everything fitted around them. They went to the right place at the right time, and it all happened as it should. So with that sort of confident, positive note, we then move from the time of the Talmud to the time of the Hasidim, that's the 18th century and the late 18th century, and the idea of teaching techniques for people to pray, meditate in prayer, and reach a deeper intensity in their prayer and in their daily life. And this concept of an actual technique of utilizing some sort of approach to Jewish thought in order to make one's prayer deeper and more profound is the very essence of what Hasidism was about. This year, Tavshin Nunchet, 5758, is actually the 300th year of the birth of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. And he taught an intense approach to prayer, a very intense approach. And it is that approach to prayer which then gets translated through his various disciples into forms that we ourselves here today are able to relate to, hopefully, in some way. And this began as something which was primarily for men. We think of men following these instructions in these different systems of prayer. However, in the 1930s in Riga, in Latvia, there began to be a circle of young women who began studying mystical teachings under the guidance of the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak Schneerson. He passed away in 1950, and he began guiding a group of young women in study of mystical teachings. And one of them, called Chaya Sima Mikhailova, wrote to him and said, how can I fill the emptiness of action? In other words, here I am, a Jewish girl, I want to be, she was probably about 18 at the time, I want to be an Orthodox Jewish girl, I want to live according to the laws of the Torah, and there are all these actions I have to do, I must do this and I mustn't do that. Riga is, I don't know if any of you have been to Riga, it's a very beautiful town. I was there in a conference a couple of years ago, talking about this subject, incidentally. And it's like Paris. It's the Paris of that bit of the world. Everywhere you go, there's a Paris. Krakow is Paris. Riga is Paris. And Paris is Paris. But it's like a cultural center. It's a very, very sophisticated city. And there she was, a girl living in Riga, and with all this sort of culture, different cultural things around her, and she wants to be part of Jewish life, and there are these actions. What do the actions mean? How do I fill the emptiness of action? And so the Rebbe wrote to her, the Rabbi Schneerson, and the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote to her what amounts to a tract on meditation. It's a fascinating document. 3 or 4 pages long in Hebrew, and it gives a system of meditation which in fact is not connected with prayer. It's a way of thinking, and he's training her to think in a particular way, and he shows how she can practice this method of thinking, and he says, if you practice this regularly, you will be able to switch it on at any moment. You'll be able to look at anything and immediately see it in this particular way, a very interesting, an unusual system of meditation. And it was clearly designed to change this young woman into an extremely profound spirit. I mean, she was already a profound person, but to bring out this inherent spirituality which was there in her. Now, this comes in a context the Chabad Yeshiva, which was begun in 1897 in the town of Lubavitch, where boys were being taught these meditative techniques. And so we're going to start with the techniques, as it were, as it was taught in that yeshiva system, which is now the Chabad Yeshiva system around the world, but as it relates to us in a general context, a general Jewish society, relating both to men and to women. And so it's in that context that we're going to look at certain of these ideas of tefillah. And we're going to start with, to help me, there are these pictures. Now here we have a drawing, which was drawn by someone to illustrate a book about Chabad. And let's just understand what's happening in the drawing. The drawing is really an imitation of a very beautiful painting, but I wasn't able to get on time the acetate of this painting. Now we see here a man in the synagogue, right? Now remember, we're talking not only men, could be women as well. Here's a man in the synagogue. He is wearing a talit but no tefillin, meaning it's Shabbat. Shabbat one has a bit more time. We don't see any other congregants near him, and the clock on the wall says 2:30. Now there are very few synagogues, even if they do have three bar mitzvahs and whatever, they're usually out of the place by 2:30. In fact, everyone went home long ago. He is there after everyone else has gone, and he is thinking. He is in a state of meditation, a state of hitbonenut, deep thinking, and it is through this deep thinking that he is praying. Or maybe he hasn't yet begun praying, he's going to. Now, we might think that that is just an imaginary thing of the past, but here is a picture of someone whom I had the great fortune to know. He taught me, his name is Rav Mendel Futterfass, Alav HaShalom, the man in the middle, and he was the person whose prayer, when I heard him praying, I'm always very late. I mean, it's a miracle I'm here on time. But I'm usually very late. And I used to pray in a minyan in Stamford Hill, which began at 7:10. And the problem with being there at 7:10 is if you came 7:15, you were late. If you came 7:20, you were uncomfortably late. If you came 7:25, it was impossible. And I would sometimes get there late. So instead of praying in that minyan, I would go round the corner to the Babbage, where they had a minyan at 7, and one at 7:30, and one at 9, and if you didn't come then, you came later. Anyway, sometimes I would be in this Lubavitch minyan, 10:30, 11, and there would be Rav Mendel Futterfass. I was then a student at university, and he was there taking no notice of me, looking rather like the person in the slide before, except that this would be on an ordinary Wednesday as well. And he would be sitting there, praying, aloud, in such a way that every word of the prayer had tremendous, tremendous meaning and feeling. It was quite incredible listening to it. You might ask, I mean, halachically, what about the minyan? You've got to pray a prayer with 10 people. There is a Hasidic saying, it's like the post. Nowadays everything's changed with email, but imagine we're 30 years ago. If you get to the post on time, you only have to pay a few pennies for the stamp. If you miss the time of the post, you have to send a telegram, and you have to pay for every word. Right? So if you're davening with a minion, okay, you put in a few pennies worth, and you're there with the minion carries you. Wonderful. But if you are praying alone in this sort of form, or in the slide we saw before, then you have to pay for every word. And every word has to be meaningful. The way that Rav Mendel prayed, every word was meaningful. And I heard that, and I never heard anything like that in my life. I've been brought up in this shul, that shul. I was surrounded by people praying. I'd never heard such a thing. A person to whom each word of Birchot Kriya Shema, the blessings before the Shema, it was just incredible. things that drew me into the whole Lubavitch world, and I began writing to the Lubavitch Rebbe and things like that. But it was this power of prayer, this intense power of prayer. Now, Reb Mendel, who, thank God, I got to know a lot after that, we studied at different times, we would talk together, he actually passed away in 1995 in London, and he's buried in London. It's a very, very special person, and he spoke a lot about prayer. He once said, a person should try to pray in a long way, in an extended way, a real prayer. If he can't, he should weep. And if he can't weep, then he should certainly weep. So in other words, to be able to feel that yearning, that longing. And interestingly, although he is talking about that in a context basically of the Chassidish of Bocha, the boy or the man praying in this intense way, there is some sense in which today the girl, the woman, the wife as well, has got this power of prayer. And in fact, I run currently a little group of women studying mystical prayer. And in a sense, what I'm telling you today is based on the experience of several months teaching this particular group, so we're going to take it a little bit further. Now, the ideas that I'm telling you are partly drawn from a book called Tanya, which has the two points I want to say about Tanya. One is Tanya has a very special relationship with the Encounter Conference that we're in today. The special relationship is that the first Encounter Conference last year was exactly on the 200th anniversary to the day of the first time that Tanya was printed. So here is the book Tanya with its English translation, and it was printed exactly 200 years ago from the first Encounter Conference last year. This is a copy of a manuscript of the Tanya before it was printed, which is in the British Library now here in London. So London and the Encounter Conference have two relationships with this interesting book, and this work Tanya is basically where I'm getting the ideas from. There is another book which was printed in Hebrew around 1900, and it's been recently translated into English, Tracts on Prayer, which takes some of these ideas and, in a sense, a few warnings as well, but it's a book written for the yeshiva students in this yeshiva where they're learning these techniques in prayer, and it wants to warn them not to go, you know, not to lose themselves. As in the story with Rabbi Akiva, we can see that there are a number of different possibilities of error. So this is a book which, in a sense, is trying to warn the young meditative, the young contemplative, not to take a wrong path. And, well, so that's there. And it also gives advice how a businessman might meditate and different approaches to meditation. However, we are going to look at today, very quickly, we are going to look at four approaches to meditation in prayer. One, two, three, four. Maybe we'll come back to this. We're going to start off with the one which is Ahavat Yisrael, and then we'll move on to the others. So let's first of all take this Ahavat Yisrael as the first approach to meditation in prayer. Okay, so you've got where we're at. There is a concept of meditation. It's a Jewish concept. It's there, even though people might associate it with something far from Judaism. In fact, it's there in Judaism. Look at that. And there is a tradition which believes in communicating this concept. And we've got it here in the form of books and teachers who were very recently with us. And we're now going to look at the first system, Ahavat Yisrael. And we're going to imagine... we might be in a synagogue, we might not be in a synagogue. It's a big problem when they close synagogues, you know, like everyone's finished praying and everyone has to leave. But here, you might be in a synagogue or we might be at home. And we're praying. Now, Shachrit, the morning prayer, there's a passage which has no great... you know, the first element of prayer is Ahavat Yisrael. That love, look at this, it is proper to say before prayer, I hereby take upon myself to fulfill the mitzvah, love your fellow man as yourself. This is written before, this translation was written before all the sensitivity about male, female, love your fellow as yourself. And then follows Ma'atovu Alecha Yaakov, how goodly are your tents Israel. Now this line, this instruction, which Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the author of Tanya, 200 years ago, put into the prayer book that he himself edited, is also in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the brief code of Jewish law, also says it's a good idea to say this before praying. And Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the great Kabbalist in Sfat 400 years ago, he said, this is something right, one should think to oneself before praying the mitzvah of Ahavat Yisrael, love of one's fellow. Now I would like to present this as the first level of a mode of contemplation particularly suitable for a synagogue. Because what it is, very simply, let's imagine that we're in a synagogue. Let's try and do this. You think of the people around you. Here we are, you and me. Here we are. Within each of us, there is a neshama, a soul, the divine soul. There are other aspects of each one of us which might be more problematic. Call it the character, the selfishness. There's the divine soul surrounded by a kind of a selfish domain. Now, I'm more aware of my selfish domain. And it's like a barrier. But let me transcend that barrier. Let me go beyond my inherent selfishness and connect with you. And each of us connect with everyone else. And just feel now, this is a person that we maybe do not know. And there are all kinds of bonds of tzniut, of modesty, of morality. It's very interesting. How goodly are your tents, Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel. This was a blessing that Bilam said to the Jewish people, and the sages comment, what was so good about the Jewish tents? That the entrances faced in different ways, that people were modest, that they were able to preserve their privacy. You can connect with someone's soul without invading their privacy. Fascinating concept, which bridges cultures and dimensions of human consciousness. It says in Tanya, actually, all the souls of the Jewish people are connected together and are one. Rak hagufim mechulakim. Only the bodies are separate. The bodies are separate. And it has to do very largely with the body and with various aspects of the person. That's where the privacy, that's where the modesty comes in. But the neshama, the soul, all the souls are connected together. And in fact, not only are we all connected together, we who are in this room, there's everyone in the whole building. There are a lot of other people, a lot of other Jewish people here in the building. We're connected very intimately with all of them. And not only with them, but all the Jews in London. And not only all the Jews in London, all the Jews in the entire world. And not only everyone in the entire world at this minute, but the people who lived 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. We're connected with them right back to Abraham. And we're even connected with all the souls who will ever be born. Because those souls still exist, already exist under the throne of glory of God. So the entire Jewish people is connected together as one vast entity. And then, feeling that sense of connection with everyone, a total, total connection, the person then says a few words. And I believe that that idea, that sense of connection that we have with the entire Jewish people who have ever lived, that gives us the money in our purse, the cash, to pay for the telegram. With that we can pay for the telegram. Because that gives us that quality of inspiration, of personal inspiration that is needed in order to carry us through the prayer. A great chassid once told me, this first approach, which is the approach of Ahavat Yisrael, Ma Tovu, that is the first step, and very simply, so that's one type of meditation. Can you just remind me how long we're going to walk together? 3:45. Yeah. See, that's it. Shabbat afternoon. Everyone's gone home. it's a problem. It's a problem how meditation, contemplation, and time, especially in the modern world, fit together. And the head of Lubavitch in the UK, Rabbi Sudan, he says, we live in a jet age. It's possible to use the intensity of the thought which is in these teachings and somehow activate it in a very short space of time. And it is. It's an interesting thing. We don't have to spend hours and hours meditating. But so we're taking it in little sound bites, as it were. So there we had Ahavat Yisrael, love of one's fellow. One part in meditation in prayer. Now we're going to look at number two, the stream of divine energy keeping the world in existence. Okay? And that will actually lead on. That will lead on to the Shema and two aspects of the Shema. Right. So we're looking at the stream of divine energy keeping the world in existence. Now, in terms of the prayer text, if one is looking at it as a sort of a journey through the prayer book, blessed is he who spoke and the world came into being. Baruch sha'amar v'hoya ha'olam. Blessed is he who spoke and the world came into being. Incidentally, there are other systems of Jewish meditation which some years ago, I think about 15 years ago, the Lubavitch Rebbe recommended that there should be developed systems of Jewish meditation not connected with prayer, as a completely separate thing. And Arya Kaplan, the late Arya Kaplan, Alav HaShalom, as a response, wrote the book Jewish Meditation, which follows a number of different types of meditation. And one of the key lines in this sort of meditation is this word, Baruch she'amar v'haya ha'olam. Somehow the syllable, om, is important in use of a line, saying it again and again and again. So systems of meditation, of Jewish meditation, much more similar to Eastern varieties, where there is a line which is taken and which is repeated again and again, which is called a mantra, which is said again and again, attempts, following the guidance of the Rebbe, to create such systems which do not use non-Jewish or idolatrous Sanskrit phrases, but use something which comes straight out of Judaism. Some of them use Baruch Shama Bahaya Olam, some of them use Ribono Shel Olam, things like that which the person repeats again and again. However, a very interesting remark made by Kaplan in his book Jewish Meditation is that the force of saying a word, a line, which you yourself have said hundreds of times, or other people have said hundreds or thousands or millions of times, is the same as saying it again and again now. So you say it once now, but you've said it so many times that it has this cumulative effect, even though at this moment you're only saying it once. So this is a very interesting marriage of different systems. Now, blessed is he who spoke and the world came into being. Now this, in the mind of someone like Reb Mendel, that was the person I showed you before, when he would say this, it meant certain things to him. And I want to try to explain very briefly what it meant, and if I can dare to try to do that. And again, quoting of sources is important, and what I'm saying is drawn from the Tanya, particularly its second section, the Gate of Unity and Faith. However, we're going to look here at this other step. The highest and the simplest always connect together. That's one of the discoveries of Hasidism. Before Hasidism, there were Kabbalists, and the Kabbalists would go higher and higher, And it got to the point that a great Kabbalist simply did not know how to communicate with anyone else. Hasidism, in some sense, finds the point where the most spiritual person is connected with a child. And so here is the Aleph-Bet, which is printed in the prayer book, almost as if, you know, so you've got a space in the prayers, you know, so teach Aleph-Bet to your little boy or your little girl, something like that. But here we have the Aleph-Bet, which in fact, this was designed by the late Lubavitcher Rebbe for the prayer book that was printed in the 1950s. And I once heard him give a talk in which he described all the Kabbalistic ins and outs of why it's in this shape and why this is here and that is there. It all followed a whole Kabbalistic background, you know, but to everyone else it just looks like the Aleph. Now the Aleph there is described by the Hasidic sages and the Kabbalists. The Aleph-Bet is the original stream of life force from the divine, from God, from the infinite, flowing into the world. And it is the point at which the finite takes, the infinite takes on, kibayachol, so to speak, finite characteristics, so as to be able to give life to this physical world that we are in. So when God says, Yehi Or, let there be light, and one of my colleagues at this moment is saying in another room that let there be light, that relates to the Big Bang, the original light ball, which, so just so that you shouldn't feel you're missing it, everything's connected together. So at that moment of saying light, those words, Yehi Or, let there be light, that is a spiritual energy which is flowing from the infinite into this realm of existence. And it's the Hebrew letters which are really the kind of the packages in which radiance is there within a particular form, so that there's the radiance of the Aleph or of the Bet. And it's taking form in such a way that it becomes part of a finite world, the world that we're living in. And so there is this stream of letters flowing into the world. Let there be light, let there be a firmament, let there be animals, plants, whatever, let there be human beings. Everything is taking form from this stream of letters. So much so that everything in existence has a spiritual dimension. The rock, Eben, the stone, has got a spiritual dimension, Aleph, Bet, Nun. And that is the spiritual dimension of the stone. The anything in the world, the name for that object is its spiritual identity. As I mentioned earlier today, NaCl, sodium chloride, is common salt. Not because people have said, well, it would be nice to call it NaCl, but because it actually is sodium chloride. That's what salt really is. If you said KCl, potassium chloride, it would be something else. Now, in the same way, shulchan, a table, really is shulchan. The spiritual identity of the table is shulchan. The spiritual identity of the chair is kisei. The spiritual identity of the stone is evet. So everything around us is really an expression of this stream of energy, of spiritual energy flowing into existence, making it all exist as a kind of a hologram. A hologram coming into being of streams of laser beams which make everything, which can make an object look as if it's there. So in the same way, there is spiritual radiance which flows in and makes the world. And that's this stream of energy. Alright. So let's come back to the person who might be in a synagogue, or he might not be. Everyone might have gone home, or he might be in a little cottage by in a wood, by a stream, you know, or on a mountain, wherever he is, or she is. And they want to follow this particular little path of meditation, and they start thinking that everything in existence is simply an expression of this stream of otiyot, of this stream of energy flowing from God. And that's a way of looking at everything around one and merging. it in a way. And so when you come to say a few words, you are part of that. You are appreciating not just that God created the world thousands of years ago, but that God's energy is continuously giving existence to the world. Okay. Now this is a second route, therefore. If we can just look back at this. This is a second route. The stream of divine energy keeping the world in existence. So the first way in which we looked at a stream, a path of meditation, is Ahavat Yisrael. Feeling one's connection with everyone else. A second route, which might be on a different day. It might not be possible to do, as it were, two different ones. You get so involved, you get so emotionally moved by one particular track, it may not be very easy to switch from one track to the other. I'm presenting them as possibilities. So the second one is the stream of divine energy keeping the world in existence. Now we come to the third one. And in the third one we have the Shema, and it is here where we, as it were, utilize this concept of a stream of divine energy keeping the world in existence, and we go a step further. Alright. Lots of things happen in the synagogue. People get called up to the Torah. Someone comes and chats with you about something. You chat with someone else about something else. A lot of people complain about talking in the synagogue. It's a paradox. If you don't talk in the synagogue, you don't know the people. One of the most precious things about coming together with people once a week or whenever it is, you have this intimate relationship with them. That's where you meet. And it might be once a year, but it's also important. And at the same time, there are all these halachic injunctions, you know, don't speak in the synagogue. You know, so maybe that all tends towards having the prayers, and then after the prayers, being together and chatting. And you see, Rav Mendel, my teacher of meditation, Rav Mendel chatted. Rav Mendel, he wouldn't chat during the actual time that you're supposed to sit quietly, you know, but afterwards, after the prayers, people, let me just explain to you his routine. He would get up early in the morning, maybe 5:30, go to the mikvah, which is a thing that Hasidic men do as a preparation for prayer. Particularly as a preparation for prayer, they go to the mikvah as a way to get themselves in the mood to pray. On a Shabbat morning, I happen to know he would then have a study session with someone, or rather in another synagogue, a non-Lubavitch synagogue, someone else. He would go and study with them for a time, with a rabbi of another synagogue. Then he would come to the Chabad synagogue, and he would take part in a study session. A Chabad synagogue usually has a study session before the prayers. So they study. The prayers are at a very late time, 10 o'clock in the morning. At 9 o'clock in the morning, there's a study session. So far, these study sessions are only for men. However, we're working on it. So there they are, studying at 9 o'clock in the morning, and Rav Mendel is there, always with tremendous, tremendous humor. And never taking himself seriously, never taking himself, and he was a very famous Hasid, but always able to laugh at himself in an incredible way, right till the end of his life. And then would be the prayers, everyone would pray, and meanwhile, during the prayers, he would have usually the book Tanya, and he would be looking at the book Tanya. And then when it came to the reading of the Torah, he would follow the reading of the Torah, and then he would go back to the Tanya, and then the prayers would finish, and everyone is going to go home, and he would sit around and chat with people, and you could hear the most fascinating conversations, and then gradually everyone else would go home, and then he would begin praying. Right. So he's beginning to pray. And let's imagine that he's thinking of this stream of divine energy keeping the world in existence, this flow of letters flowing into the world. It's almost like something that you could gaze at, this image of the alphabet that a person could sort of, you know, like have have on their wall, you know, like to just think of, to use as an aid to meditation. Now, the Shema, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. What do we mean when we say, the Lord our God, the Lord is one? Do we mean there's one God and not three gods, or not many gods? What is the argument? The way it explains it in Tanya is that what we are saying is, there is only God. All existence is an expression of God. Ein od milvado, there is nothing apart from God. And at that moment that the person says the Shema, at that moment they are able to appreciate that profound concept that there is nothing apart from God, and at that moment that is the reality for the person. Ein od milvado, there is nothing apart from God. And at that moment, there's no world. The world has dissolved away into godliness. Because if the letters of the word shulchan make the table, and the letters of the word kisei make the chair, then everything around us really is an expression of the stream of these letters. And these letters are emanating from the divine, and the divine, the infinite, is the source of all these letters. So there is only the divine, there is nothing else, and everything else that we see, that we appear to see, is simply a concealment of God. It's a hiddenness of God, and in fact the word ha'olam in Hebrew, if you write it chaser, hey ayin lamad mem, is the same letters as the word he'elem, concealment. World equals concealment. So the world is a concealment of godliness. Ha'olam he'elem. So the world is a concealment of godliness. That's the definition of world. And when you take away the concealment, there is only God. So the person going through the path of the prayer, meditating, thinking through the prayer, comes to this declaration of the Shema that there is only God, there is no world. And that is called the upper unity. Now, this is potentially a dangerous conceptual step. Because the person might think, since there is only God, how can I relate to the daily world? How can I get a job? How can I answer letters on time? How can I keep the phone bill paid? How can I do this? How can I do that? How can I get married? How can I bring up children? How can it all fit in? There is this person who is living in, he has entered this realm where there is only God, there is no world. How does this fit together with concrete reality? And this is potentially a real problem. I mean, Hasidim are well known as being very bad at keeping opponents on time. But, Loizu Hader, after the upper unity comes the lower unity. The lower unity is expressed in the second phrase, blessed be the name of the glory of his kingdom forever and ever, which we say in a whisper, and there's a whole halachic discussion about it. It's not written in the Torah, in the Devarim, in Vayet Chanan, it's something else is written. You don't have that. It's the answer Jacob gave to his children. I'm not going into that whole thing. What does it mean? Come the mystics say, you know what? It means the same thing. It means, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. It's expressing, it's affirming the oneness of God, but it's affirming it in a different way. It's saying not that there is only God and there is no world. There is a world, here is the world, and in this world we can discover godliness. That's what this second line is saying. So the second line of the Shema is the lower unity, is discovering godliness here in the world. And it's like another turn into reality and discovering godliness in reality. And that's the most fantastic putting together of the highest level of the spiritual together with our physical, practical world. We're not trying to run away from the world. Jewish meditation does not run away from the world. Jewish meditation ascends to the heights and uses that discovery of radiance to go into the world and be in a much more full and whole way, a wholesome way, a part of the world and a part of society and a part of humanity. So there we have the concept of the Shema, and we're only taking like tiny little bites of this, and I hope no one's going to get indigestion. The upper unity and the lower unity. And finally, very, very briefly, having gone through all this experience. You can understand now why it's 2:30 in the afternoon. It's, having gone through experiences of this type, one finally comes to saying the Amida. Now, it happened in the siddur that I was photocopying. The Mincha siddur, the Mincha Amida, in it. And that's not by chance. Nothing's by chance. Because Mincha could just as easily be a vehicle for this kind of spirituality. Mincha might be the afternoon prayer in the middle of a rush day in the office. Especially now, this time of year, one has to say the afternoon prayer before the sunset, whatever. So, right, I'm going to say the afternoon prayer. Now, that afternoon prayer can have all the power of Jewish spirituality in it. We live in a jet age. We can do things at once, an email age. So it can happen right away. And so the person can focus in such a way that there is this quality of selflessness expressed in the words, "My Lord, open my lips and my mouth shall declare your praise." What do we say? Why should God open my lips? Why don't I open my lips? And the answer is, because having gone through the intensity of feeling and seeing the way that the world is subsumed in godliness, and then that there is a world, and we're going to discover God in the world, one can become, the Hebrew word is bittul, selflessness. One can attain a quality of selflessness. I can't open my lips. God will have to open my lips. It's this sense what the European artists call automatic. It's that step beyond the self. It's not the self who's saying. It's God speaking through the person. What does it mean, God speaking through you? God through the sages, the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, who wrote the prayers 2,400 years ago. They wrote these words, and I'm now saying these words. I'm saying the words instructed by God, but it's not me. It's something else speaking through me. And in fact, it's the soul. It's the collective soul of the entire Jewish people through the ages. Here we connect the beginning and the end. That collective soul speaking through us, saying the words of the tefillah. We may be able to say them in Hebrew, we may only be able to say them in English at the moment, but we're saying those words, and it's with a sense of total selflessness. And finally, at the last stage in this that we're going to touch on, we have at some point during the prayer, we have Modin. And this is even a passage which, when the reader who is repeating the Amida, he comes to this, everyone says this little passage. We all say that in unison with the reader. Now, Modim, we thankfully acknowledge. This concept of thankfully acknowledge is something very profound. At that moment, Modim, you know, the praxis, the practical way in which people pray. They're facing east, and at that moment that they say Modim, they bow, Modim, they're standing with their feet together, like with this stillness. The idea of the feet together really comes from Yechezkel, Ezekiel's description of the chariot, and the angels have only one leg. And we are imitating the angels, so we stand together with our feet together like the angels only having one leg. And then when we come to Modim, we bow. And that bowing, it's a moment of submission and of simply becoming one with God at that moment. Becoming one with God in the way that we're doing it individual, me, my ideas. We're doing it as a soul, as part of the collective unity of the Jewish people. And that collective unity is really a part of God. It's the presence of God in this world. And at that moment, we touch. Now, okay, so we've looked a little bit at a few different approaches to spirituality and prayer. Each one of these can be explored at much greater depth, obviously, and can be taken much further. But I hope that it's opened a door of possibility to meditative, contemplative prayer here today in our world. Thank you.
When I was studying in yeshiva, and I used to go to various shurim, it always struck me that the measure of what made a good shur was, of course, the intellectual brilliance of the information that was presented, and the way that it was presented, and the truth with which it was presented. But I always felt that there was one more ingredient, and that was that I always knew that I'd been to a shur which was exciting when I came out of the shur and I wanted to dance, and I wanted to pray. And I always felt that that was kind of the measure that I'd been to an experience which was a true reflection of Jewish tradition, of something that was spiritual. I think this afternoon we've had a treat in the Dr. Nerton's given us a class, a lecture, a shiur, which has not only been informative, not only been in parts brilliant and intellectually exciting, and not only given me the will to dhamma, but I think given us all the will to dhamma with kavana and to really try out some of the spiritual journey and methods of going on those journeys that Dr. Nerton has presented to us. So first of all, many, many thanks. We have about half an hour for questions, just under half an hour. Dr. Nerton, there's many parts of us, so please.
We repeat the question into the microphone. Okay, all right.
Okay, I've always thought of meditation as getting into yourself and maybe concentrating on, let's say, a Hebrew letter or concentrating on a flower or something like this. And I've found what you said a bit difficult to comprehend. It's a different type of meditation. Can you explain
right,
the difference between that type of meditation?
Right. Now, there are types of meditation which are Hebrew adaptations of regular systems of meditation which are floating around the whole of the United States, California particularly, which are a kind of amalgam of Eastern, Far Eastern systems of meditation combined with various psychological Jungian transformations of that into something which fits into Western consciousness. And I did mention the existence of these. So Arya Kaplan, for example, has written about these to some extent. And there is a sort of a whole world of meditation, which really, if you went into a non-Jewish Californian meditation center, or you went into a Jewish Californian meditation center, they would be doing more or less the same thing, except that one may take a Hebrew symbol and the other not, right? And that's perfectly all right, and in fact that's something the Lubavitcher Rebbe did speak about and encouraged and thought was an important thing. What I'm speaking about is something different. I'm speaking about a system of meditation which actually goes back many centuries in Jewish thought and emerges from Jewish teachings and is part of what Jewish teaching is actually saying about a very, very spiritual experience in the life of every Jew, potentially, which is daily prayer. And there is prayer with the idea of saying the Shema in the morning and in the evening, and at some point saying the Amida in the morning and the afternoon and the evening, and at least once a day for women, as the halachic authorities say. So there is this context of the concept of Jewish prayer. And in that context is there already this deep mystical dimension. So for the person who's coming from another direction, So, for example, I used to know a young man who was deeply involved in a particular movement of transcendental meditation. And he was very much involved with this. And he began to also find an interest in Judaism. And he began putting on tefillin and doing various Jewish things. He made his home kasher and he began observing Judaism in the proper way. There was one problem he had, one big problem. In transcendental meditation, he would find this deep relaxation, he would find this deep, quote-unquote, spiritual experience, which he was finding there. And where was that in Judaism? And so what we did together, we began learning through one of these Hebrew texts about meditative prayer. And he found how to get that same buzz, if you like, or more, much more, in a traditional system of Jewish meditation and contemplation. So